This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. How does virtual learning work for visually impaired students? Most K through 12 curricula exclusively cater to the sighted, and it's taken over a century of activism just to start adapting classrooms for those who can't see the whiteboard. But taking a whole classroom online? That is the immediate challenge for the Governor Moorhead School, North Carolina's public school for visually impaired students. Janet Perez is the school's instructional and assistive technology facilitator, and she's with us today to talk about the challenges of this coming school year and about her own upbringing. We'll hear about her push to move beyond the philosophy of integration and assimilation in our educational system. Janet Perez, welcome to the State of Things.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
I want to talk about the many ways that your personal history has informed the way you approach your job, but let's start with what you're doing right now. How does online learning work for visually impaired students?
Well, it actually works the same way it does for sighted students when the technology is accessible. So that is the greatest challenge. Our students who are blind use screen readers. They may use Braille displays. So they have access when they can get access. They know how to use the tools. So that's what we kind of work on. Our students use a learning management system. They know how to upload assignments. They know how to send emails. It's just, are we providing them with accessible apps and resources?
I'm also fascinated with this question of how to discuss race with visually impaired students. It's something that is a deep part of your personal history in some ways, not the visual impairment, but certainly questions of cultural competence and cultural difference. And I know that identifying race is something that we do more than just use more than just sight, but it certainly is a primary means. How do you have these conversations?
I think around the topic of race, the first thing you need is a relationship. You need to build a relationship that's built on commonality and not just on differences. And you would think that within the community of people who are blind, that race doesn't even play a big part because they can't see it. From working with people who are blind, I've learned that race is a mental construction. Whether they can see you or not, children are born believing certain things about certain people. It's kind of like COVID. I thought about that the other day. You know, we have young children who may appear asymptomatic, but we've contaminated them with our own prior experiences and mindsets. And it may not show up until like third grade, where we get that prison pipeline of prison from school. So I think one is having the open conversation with creating relationships. And then two, not stepping back when the topic comes up.
How do you feel about identifying your race to students?
Well, I'm cool. A lot of times my students don't know that I'm Black. For example, once I was on the I was taking the train to Charlotte Amtrak, and I met one of my students, a young lady who had been in my class for like weeks, and she was still in my class. So we were talking. I don't know what we were talking about, but at some point I said, as a Black woman, and she froze. I mean, she literally froze. And she's like, I didn't know you were Black. And I said, are you okay with that? I mean, do we need to change the conversation? Do I need to sit someplace else? And in that moment, I saw that she had to do some readjustments with her concepts of who I was, because she obviously had me pegged as a white woman.
It's interesting the questions that raises, because on the one hand, you'd like to think you go in with a blank slate. You'd like to think, oh, here's an opportunity where we can get beyond the question of race and just identify each other based on our relationships. On the other hand, as you said, these constructions are real, and once people find out, they start to adjust their thinking. Is it important for teachers to identify their race to their students, or is it important that they not do it? It's kind of interesting in both ways, because on the one hand, you can open the question then, right, and talk more openly about it. On the other hand, it does give you the opportunity to proceed as though race didn't matter.
One of the things that I recall from a workshop that I attended on diversity the North Carolina Teaching Fellows did a wonderful job on presenting diversity to college students. And during one of the breaks, a teacher who was a facilitator was bragging on the fact that she doesn't let her Spanish kids speak Spanish in her classroom. And my comment to her was, that's like telling me I can't bring my brown skin into your classroom. So I think teachers should bring their whole selves into the classroom. That's how we make community. You know, how can you tell me to leave part of me outside of me?
And you have your own personal history, a fascinating history in the classroom, both as a teacher in North Carolina, we'll get to that, but as a student in New York City, talk about going to school in elementary school.
I didn't realize until I became a teacher that I was a bus child. I was one of the bus students. And being a teacher, I saw how students were perceived who were bused. So it made me go back and look at all of my experiences. And interestingly enough, I loved my third grade teacher. We all did. And I always wanted to thank him. And I wrote this long essay. And I kept looking for him, but I couldn't find him. And one year, I actually reconnected. He had become a veterinarian. That's why I couldn't find him in the school system. And we actually met at the Helen Keller Center in New York and had lunch. And I tried to, in a sense, get his perspective of what it was like to be a white teacher during integration. And I could not get him to talk about it. Martin Luther King was assassinated the year I was in his class, and he could not talk about it.
Were you aware of the push to integrate schools? I mean, did you realize that this was part of a movement when you were going to school?
No, actually what happened, I started out at PS 80 with my older sister, and everything was fine. PS 80 was an integrated school, and it was close to my house. For some reason, some adult somewhere decided we needed to bus some of the kids from PS 80 to PS 156. So like overnight, my sister's going to one school, I'm going to another. And that was really shocking because I was like hollering, Mama, don't leave me here, because I didn't know these people. But after, you know, school got going, kids get along for the most part. You make friends. You love learning. So it wasn't until really fourth grade that I had a teacher who kind of made me feel that I didn't belong because I'm on free reduced lunch. You have to bring the papers in wherever it said father. My mother never put anything, and she would scold me, go tell your mother to fill this out. Well, no, my mother doesn't want to fill that part out.
Did you, so that was the first time, fourth grade, when you say you didn't fit in. After that, you began to notice too that the expectations, when did it first, was it obvious to you that there was a different set of expectations for you and other black students?
And let me hit pause on that because I did have an early experience. It was on television. I was seeing the policemen with the dogs, the German shepherds, the firemen with the hoses. And looking back, because I've shown this documentary to my students, I realized what I saw was the Children's March. And I remember being terrorized because in school we were taught your community helpers, the police, the firemen. Yet on TV, I saw all this protest. And these were young people. And I remember going outside and looking up and saying, God, do you like black people? And maybe I didn't say black people. Maybe I said Negroes. But that was such a shocking experience. And yet, connecting to my community, the answer came back red and yellow, black and white. They are precious in his sight. And that has been like a seed that has stabilized me. That is the truth that I live.
Were you able to take home to your family and your community those feelings in fourth grade when you finally, when you first felt like you didn't fit in? And talk about that. How did you handle that?
Okay, there's something called a double bind. That you can put a kid in a double bind because they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. I was taught by some of my aunts that whatever you do, you can be friends with white people, but don't ever trust them. So that was the message I was given. Yet I'm going to a school where my classmates and my teachers are predominantly white. So how do you send kids forward with this dichotomy of messages? And in school, you're getting the subtle messages that being excellent at something is being white. It's not being excellent, it's being white. So I think I struggled with that, to be honest. And there really wasn't anyone to really talk to about it. No one at school, at home. You know, there was all this conversation about what was going on within the Black movement. But if you don't want to hate anybody, but you can't trust certain people, for a child, that's a double bond. And that's psychologically unhealthy.
We will talk about the way Janet Perez navigated those thoughts and brought them to her current job as assistive technology facilitator at the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind, also instructional and assistive technology facilitator at the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind. We'll talk more about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Janet Perez was a student in some of the first integrated classrooms in New York City. She went on to serve in the military before returning to education and teaching in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District. That was during a time when a statistically deceptive strategy called tracking was actually resegregating schools across the country. Janet is now the Instructional and Assistive Technology Facilitator at the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind in Raleigh. Let's talk a little bit about your experience coming of age during the 70s in New York City, where, you know, you went to school in some of the first, when forced integration, I guess, was going in place. Talk about that experience.
Well, actually, I started school in the mid-60s, and just like most young children, you go to school with this excitement, and you don't realize that you're being bused. I did not realize, I know I took the bus to school, but I didn't realize that there was a stigma attached to busing until I became a teacher. And then I started reevaluating my experiences to see, wow, is this what my teachers thought of me?
Did you have any sense of, so you're saying you really didn't have a sense of that in the classroom while you were going to school in the 60s. You didn't feel that because I guess you had nothing to compare it to, right?
Well, and okay, in a sense, yes, because I was placed in academically gifted classes in fourth and fifth grade. So kindergarten, first grade, second grade, I think that's cool. We had a great third grade teacher, Mr. Dribben. But around fourth grade, I started feeling subtle messages that you don't belong here. And one of the things that I saw as a teacher and then reflected back on, we were given like a checklist of, you know, these are the signs of an at-risk kid. And I realized, whoa, I had a lot of those. I was on free reduced lunch, a single mom, you know, so all these little indicators that said you are set up not to succeed. And so we know teacher expectation and student achievement, there is this correlation between the two. And so I think I felt that I was being held to a lower level of expectation, or when I did well, it was, did you really do this? Did you really write this?
Hmm. You had that experience, a particular experience just like that, at least one, right?
I've had more than one.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, many experiences where they actually turned back work and said, you know, was this yours? Was it the Langston Hughes piece that it maybe sticks out for you?
Well, the Langston Hughes piece actually occurred in college. Mm. I was in college before someone ever said, is this your best work? Mm. And that has stuck with me as a teacher because so often we go by grades. I could take a test. I can get an A. Okay, I'm a good test taker. But to have someone say, is this your best work? So that's what I mean when I said people have lower expectations. Just because I was getting A's, they assumed that was my best. And it wasn't.
Coming of age, you know, in the 70s then, when there was some real diversity in Black thought, things were really starting to open up, and there was the Black nationalist movement that was now sort of competing with the assimilation idea and integration idea. Were you paying attention to any of that at the time?
So in middle school, we call it the junior high school, I placed in what was an accelerated program where I did 3 years and two. So basically you got skipped. And those classes were predominantly white. And yes, very much aware, because the music of that era was social awareness. What's going on, Marvin Gaye, right? Gil Scott-Heron, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. A classmate, Michelle, who was always black, who was also black, we did that as a class project. We just did that as our speak out, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And somebody said, well, what was the reaction from the students in the class, from the white students? And for me, it wasn't about the white students. It was finding my voice and speaking my voice. At the same time, in middle school, I started reading literature from the Black Panthers. Don't everybody turn off right now. When I started reading literature, I fell in love with Huey Newton. Okay, I think that was my first crush, because they were taking the Declaration of Independence and turning it on this country to say we have rights. You know, we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and it's not happening. I was very much aware.
And I want to take you to that moment where you just said, "Now, don't turn this off yet." I mean, are we getting to the point where we don't have to apologize for understanding what was behind the Black Panther movement, feeding children, giving them a sense of identity, giving them a sense of belonging, the big picture? Are we there yet where we don't have to apologize for understanding what that movement was about?
I think the fact that I just did apologize says a lot. and you know, I just recently watched a documentary called Crip Camp, C-R-I-P camp, and it's about the disability revolution. And what I've learned in that documentary, and it's on YouTube, I highly recommend it, I learned that the Black Panthers supported the people who were fighting and protesting for the ADA. They were feeding them. That's so cool, because they have, you know, too often we hear the demonized version of the Black Panthers. But really, they were building up the self-esteem of so many people who really had been bombarded with images of being less than. I mean, we have to understand that this society was doing experiments to prove that Black people were less than people. We grew up with that. Jesse Jackson. Reggie Jackson's a Yankee. That's another.
another Reggie hero, Jackson, yeah.
Yeah, right? But especially when they won the World Series. But anyway, I am a Yankee fan. Jesse Jackson had this thing, I am somebody, you know, and that was the mantra. And yet I remember sitting with my friends, and one summer we were just hanging out, and we were joking about, yeah, I am somebody. I may not have school clothes for next school year, but I am somebody. So we were making fun, because that was our way of coping with this constant negative image. And so I do appreciate that I came up when Stokely Carmichael was saying Black Power and James Brown was singing Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. That meant something to us. And then to be able to wear our hair naturally, you do not know. If you've never had your hair pressed, you do not understand what that torture is like. I don't care what anyone says. And so to be able just to wear your hair, that was so freeing and liberating.
Well, and fast forward to what you're doing now, working with impaired students at the Governor's School, at the school right now, where you're working, the Governor Moorhead School. The idea, and as you mentioned, the Black Panthers stood in solidarity with and for the ADA. What that meant was a transfer in the emphasis of the movement from doing for to doing with, so that if we empower ourselves to take what is ours, which is a little bit what the ADA was about, this is not about pity anymore. It's not about doing for us. It's about us taking control and telling you what we can do. And that what we can do is important for you to understand, because I understand the word impaired is now part of my label. Is that sort of part of your thinking now as you approach this job? Empowerment and self-empowerment and the idea that we're going to take responsibility for these changes and the kinds of improvements that we think should be made.
One of the areas that's in the curriculum for students with visual impairment is called advocacy skills. That is something we specifically teach to our students, because going forth into a society where you are the different one, sometimes you're going to have to knock on doors, sometimes you're going to have to kick on them, and sometimes you're going to have to get to the other side and say, I'm not leaving until you help me. So knowing how to advocate appropriately, but before I can advocate, I need to have a positive self-image. So building up the skills and being able to tell people, I don't need this from you right now, but this is what I need. Mm. For example, a friend sent me an article, and the woman is blind who wrote it, and she said, I'll stand at the corner with my cane and somebody will come over, grab me, and start pushing me in a direction I don't even want to go. But in the beginning, she didn't advocate because she didn't want to lose an ally. But as she grew in her confidence, she was able to say, please, this isn't what I need, but this is what I need.
I want to talk more about how your story, your personal story, fits into all of this and brought you to where you are, because we talked about going to school. You were an A student. You knew how to get A's. You're also becoming more conscious of this movement. So this is about the time, middle school, I think, when you start cutting class a little bit.
Ooh, I did worse than that. But anyway, we won't talk about that. From an educator's perspective, yes, I have, from my personal experience, gained compassion and insight. For one example, I've taught at a Christian school, predominantly white, in Charlotte, and I noticed an African-American young girl who was struggling, but she was getting A's, she had all the teacher's accolades, and I went to the AG instructor and said, she's struggling, can we get her a mentor that can help her? And the teacher's like, oh, she's fine, she never says anything. And I shared my story about being in middle school in an AG class, and it was like dismissed, to be honest. Like, what do you know? But in the spring, this teacher went to a conference where these professors who were white were sharing the same things that I had just shared. And she's like, wow, I went to this conference and this is what I learned. And what I said to her was, who do you think they interview for their research studies? Hmm.
And did you inform them? Yeah. Yeah.
Experience gets discounted because what do you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. So this is something that, but was this what was on your mind as a middle schooler? In other words, what was happening to you that made you lose interest at that time?
It didn't connect with my world.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what happened. What I was learning, okay, I'm sure Old Man in the Sea by Ernest Hemingway is a fine novel. I didn't get it. It didn't connect with my world. So much was going on the outside and on the inside, but what school was doing had no connection to what I was learning. So in a sense, I dropped out in middle school. But I was still able to get skipped, even though I was cutting left and right. I dropped out.
That gets back to the expectations, right?
And not seeing yourself represented in all the curriculum. You know, there's a joke, that every February we get to learn about the same 10 black people. Right. And so if someone would have told me in middle school about Katherine Johnson, the mathematician, I would have been on it. That is a fabulous story. I never heard about her until the movie came out.
I want to talk about your career in the military as well. But let me just say this about The Old Man in the Sea. The one thing I liked about taking that in high school is it was short. I didn't get it. Yes, because what else is there? He's in the boat. He's waiting for the fish. But luckily it ended quickly because I couldn't take a minute of it. Okay, so let's talk about your career in the military because you did join. Why did you join the military?
I joined the military because I wanted to go to college. My mother never went to high school. That's one more of those indicators for at-risk kids. But my mother was smart and wise and brilliant. But because she grew up in Jim Crow South, she was the oldest girl out of like 12 siblings, her opportunities were limited. So for my mom, graduating high school was like the apex. And I did not want my mother, who worked 2 and 3 jobs as a CNA or a housekeeper, to have to go into debt for me to go to college. So the military had this great opportunity, join and we'll help pay for your college. So that's how I got into the military. I went in at 17 because I had skipped a grade in school. And my grades, I mean, my test scores with the military were so good that I enlisted as military intelligence. I was going to be a code breaker. I was going to learn Morse code. But then you had to get an FBI secret, top secret clearance. I'm 17. This is my disclaimer. I am 17, folks. So they asked me, one of the questions they asked me was, would you do anything for your country? Well, I had been reading Black Panther, getting a little bit into Malcolm X, and I looked at the man and said, no, okay? And he looked at me like, so what wouldn't you do? And what I said was, I wouldn't have gone to Vietnam, which was a very radical thing to say. Again, I'm 17. To every vet who went to Vietnam, I highly respect you. That is my disclaimer, because you did serve your country under really tough conditions. But at the time, I said I wouldn't go to Vietnam because that's what I was reading about, the injustice that was going on in the military. So needless to say, they kicked me out of military intelligence, and that's how I got into computers and technology.
And then when you decided to make it your career, they decided it probably wasn't best for you, right?
Okay, so yes, I got stationed in Germany, Worms, Germany, which was also the first place in my life that someone called me the N-word. It was also the first place in my life that I was told I could not come in because of my color. So that was shocking, to be honest. That was shocking. So again, I'm still reading a lot of Black literature, and we had a Black history program every year, and I wrote a piece which basically said, hey folks, we're Black, we're not Americans. Don't ever think that you really have all the rights that everybody else has in this country, which was not a good thing to do when you're in the military. Unfortunately, I was close to being discharged. And typically, when you're close to your end of your service, they try to get you to re-enlist. You get a re-up conference, and they did not offer me one. My sergeant said, Janet, just go home and go to school, okay? Just drop it, because I was going to say, where's my re-up? I want to re-up. They're like, go home, go to school, which is what I did.
Which is what you did. You also married into a Puerto Rican family, which figures heavily also into your understanding of how things work right now. Tell us a little about that.
Now, that's an interesting story, and if my ex-husband is listening, I apologize, okay, because I'm going to talk a little bit about you. So I'm going to Central Piedmont Community College. I'm going to college, and there are some people who have a stigma about people who go to community college. We have all these stigmas. But anyway, we're chatting. I was one who liked to take telecourses to go at a self-pace, and at the time, you had to watch these videos. And so my ex-husband, he was working in that section, and we started talking, and I got this feeling that he liked me, and I was like, I don't know why that white guy's liking me. So he invited me to lunch one day, and I lied. I lied. I said, oh, I have something to do, and I really didn't, and I really had planned to go to lunch at the little cafe across the street. So I waited and waited and said, okay, I think it's okay to go across the street. The only booth in the restaurant was right in back of him. Okay. Do you know what that feels like? You're like, you got caught in this lie. Later on, he told me, he said, I thought you were the most stuck up girl. And I said, I would never talk to you again. Never say never. Right. And so we didn't for a long while, but then the next semester I took an art class. His brother was like the art assistant, and he kept talking about his brother. You know, his brother liked to camp. His brother was reading Malcolm X. And I'm thinking, whoa, his brother sounds interesting. So one day, the guy that invited me to lunch walked in, and the art assistant said, hey, I want you to meet my brother. And it was another awkward experience, because what happened was he didn't change. His looks didn't change. The only thing that changed was the label I put on him. He went from being white to Puerto Rican, but he looked the same. And it taught me, going back to Martin Luther King, that we're living a day where people are not judged by the color of their skin. but I had done that to him. So it really challenged me, and that's how we ended up dating, because now I saw him differently because I changed the label. But I'm at the place where we can do away with a lot of labels. That's where we need to be. All these labels are dividing us, and we're not seeing clearly.
We'll talk more about those visions that you've had, the ways in which you've come to new understandings and epiphanies, as I continue my conversation with Janet Perez this hour, an instructional assistive technology facilitator at the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind. We'll talk about it on the State of Things after this. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and on Mondays, you know, we meet some of our state's most interesting people. Today, we're talking with Janet Perez, who grew up in New York City, surrounded by the promise of the Civil Rights Movement, came of age alongside the Black Power Movement, and after serving abroad in the military, Janet returned stateside to serve in the education system. She is currently instructional and assistive technology facilitator at the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind in Raleigh. But before that, she did a tour of duty in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District. So we left you in the military. You left. You didn't get your re-up. They suggested you go back and go to school. You did. What brought you to education?
Well, I think in the Black community, education is highly valued. Even now, I tell my students that I grew up when the commercial was the Negro College Fund, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. I still tell my students that. So just this whole mindset that this is how you get ahead. This is how you stand on the shoulders of people who fought before you to have this opportunity. My mother shared how she went to a one-room schoolhouse with like 70 kids, while the white children in her community, they took the buses and they had the nice school building. So my mother actually was insistent that her younger siblings finish school, because back in Jim Crow South, they were sharecroppers and you didn't go to school when crops were there. And she would fight with the, I don't know what you call it, the landlord, that no, my siblings are going to school. So my mother really, that was really important for her. She bought us World Book encyclopedias. She made sure we got to the library. So it was my home culture, I would think. And it's also because back then, women weren't given so many opportunities. It was secretary, nurse, or teacher, typically. Mm. I didn't do blood. I didn't want to be a secretary. I'm not organized. And so part of it was teacher.
You did, and then you arrived in Charlotte in the early 90s, where classes should have been pretty well integrated by then. When you arrived, what did you see when you walked into that classroom for the first time?
I started teaching at one of the first magnet schools in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. Magnet schools get federal money for choice integration, to promote choice integration. And technically, on paper, the school was integrated, because 3-5 was the academically gifted program, which you had to test in, and K-2 was called the learning immersion program, which on paper sounded great. The reason I went to that school was I was working as a parent educator before with mostly teen moms, and the brochure came out about, oh, here are our new magnet schools. So I was talking to parents like, oh, this sounds like a really interesting school. Lots of hands-on learning, field trips. My supervisor, who was white, when I told her what I was doing, she said to me, but Janet, no, we don't want our students in our program going to that school. And I said, why not? And she said, because it's for children who haven't had preschool experiences. And I said, where does it say that in this brochure? And she pointed to two words, social skills. Okay? I had worked as a teacher assistant in kindergarten. I understand that all young children need social skills, but I learned that this is a code word. I also learned if I didn't go to the right church or wasn't part of the right club, I wasn't going to learn this knowledge. This information wasn't coming to me. We say knowledge is power, but you need to be connected with the community that has the power or you'll lose out. All this said, when I've finally applied to Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, I only put one school down, and it was the school that they told me we didn't want our kids going to, because I wanted to know what was going on. My first class at a a magnet school for choice integration was all Black. In all my K-12 education in New York, I had always been in integrated classes. Mm. So I was at first, I was shocked. I was angry. Okay, maybe I should say I was angry because I was seeing so many, everything was so Black and white. Right. We had a 10-day card that we had to fill out, you know, to track attendance. And at the bottom of the card, it said, basically, if you're not Black, then you will be deemed white. So that was Hispanic, Asian, Native American. And I went to the secretary and said, how are we tracking Black people? Why is everybody else lumped together except for Black people? And she was like, Janet, just that's the card. I don't think they do that anymore. One of my parents walked in the room, Black parent. She said, Ms. Perez, do you have any white kids in your class? I said, no, and don't say a word. But at the end of the school year, raise hell, because we are doing fine. Instead of doing Black history in February, we did Black history all year long. Hmm. And at that point, I realized what I didn't. I got a lot in New York, but I realized what I didn't get. And that was this positive self-image, not just in February, but from August to June.
Well, this is, I want to pull all this apart because it's fascinating the way you made the best use of and got the best value from what is a deceptive situation, right, that you didn't create, that they created. I want to know more about how this works, though. So part of it is this tracking, this document that lumps everybody together who is not Black and makes them all white. But what about the system, the two-tiered system? You talked about certain grades were a kind of education. And how does that play into all of this, this deception? Tell us how that works, how you can be integrated on paper but not in reality.
Well, that you might need another gift for that one, because that is so, in a sense, a system that people thought they were doing well for the K-2 kids. It goes back to expectations. Mm-hmm. What actually happened, when they created the magnet school, it was called the Comer model. And James Comer, Black psychiatrist who really studied achievement and what it took to create high achievement levels for Black students. So it was a sound program, but we just didn't implement it fully. We implemented it on paper because one of the things in the Comer model was family connection, that you felt welcome. And not just welcome, that you're part of the system. And let me just go back to tracking with the card. They did do away with that. What really hurts is that during my tenure as a teacher in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, I saw schools resegregate. And that was like the beginning of losing faith in the education system. At the same time, I also learned that just because something was all Black, because that was another stigma, that if it's all Black or all Black neighborhood or all Black school, there must be something wrong with it. But it's not necessarily, because white people have all white neighborhoods, and we don't think they're bad. So we have this stigma that if it's all Black, there's something wrong with it. So on paper, and really, honestly, I think the K-2's classes were to justify the academically gifted program. When they made the school, they told the parents, we will add a grade to Comer model every year. So we will go from K-2 to K-5. So the second year, they added a third grade class. And at this time, you're getting the grades for the schools, the A's, the B's, and you're getting bonuses for the teachers. Well, the second year, our school didn't get a bonus because now you have your AG class, and now you have the regular third grade class, which in a sense pulled down the scores. So without really consulting the parents and having this community meeting, they discarded the third grade classes. They said K-2 will be it, which had parents scrambling to find the next school for their child. And so after that point, our school always got bonuses because we had the AD kids taking the test, and that's what those bonuses were based on. But we really weren't comparing apples to apples when you look at the other schools who had everybody. Right. I don't know if that makes sense, but I saw.
Yeah.
How
well, so you've got the so in other words, the school looks good on paper, but you still are segregating the classes because you're lumping these kids by some other set of distinctions into a classroom together, even though the school has some numbers and again artificial numbers because of the way you define white.
Well, yes. Well, in a magnet school, the K-2, anybody could come. Mm-hmm. White parents chose not to come. To entice the white parents, they had a condition that if you put your K-2 child, let's say if you're a white parent, and you had a child who did test into AG, but they were on the waiting list, if you put your younger child in the K-2, then your older child immediately got to the top of the AG list. My colleague across the hall said one day, she said, this woman asked me if she should sacrifice her kindergarten school, her kindergartner, so that her fifth grader can come to the school. And Rosalie was a very bubbly woman. And she's like, ma'am, I'm not in a child sacrifice. You know, this is not about sacrificing your child. We have a sound educational program.
So I want to make again the connection with your experiences there now as a teacher with what you're doing today. And I don't know, this may be a stretch, but you now teach classes with students who have some form of visual impairment. And as you were describing the advantages just before that of teaching just black students, now you could make, you know, every month is February, every month is Black History Month, and you could spend more time on that than you might in an integrated class. So that was for you an advantage. And I'm wondering if you have new reflections about a doctrine that the civil rights movement fought against, which is separate but equal, about the advantages. Now we'll talk about students with other abilities.
I saw a graphic recently, and it had four circles. One was called exclusion. One was called segregation. One was called integration, which we thought was the end. But the last one is called inclusion, where we all belong. I read a book when I was teaching in elementary school, and it was by Vivian Gustin Paley. And the name of the book was You Can't Say You Can't Play. And so she opened up this conversation about the dominant children who push other children out. And I remember going to class one day saying to the students, do you think we could have that rule? And they were like, oh no, Ms. Perez, it would be too many arguments. It just won't work. And I said, well, let's try for like 2 weeks and see what happens. In the beginning, there was conflict, but when you take away this label that you can't play, this is my space, you teach young people how to make better connections. Mm. And I think that's, for me, where I am today in my education. Right now, if you come into the library, that's my headquarters, you will see a poster that says relationships. Mm. And one of the things I learned as an educator was to go for global themes that you can connect lots of ideas to. And relationships are all over the place. We have the relationship with ourselves, with others, and with our environment. And in that, you make a bigger circle that can be more inclusive. And so then you start making connections with stories, which is why the arts are so very, very important, because they teach us how to listen to other people's stories and how to tell our own. And that's where we make the connections. It's not with technology. Technology is a tool, but with our stories, that's how we connect.
Well, and it seems to me technology is the one tool that we may create some of the biggest struggles. While there are opportunities, obviously, for online learning, also some struggles as well. Maybe we could illustrate one of the difficulties that your students face. You sent over a recording of you testing out a screen reader that translates writing to audio. Here's the software reading an online presentation.
Button, button, button.
Button.
Button, button.
I have three buttons here, and they're not
button,
labeled.
Button.
I can assume that one is the next button.
Button.
I heard it changed.
Button. DF5E7D243B7A9494523DBEAD12430JPEG. Image.
This says a brief history of AI.
Button. Button.
Janet Perez using a screen reader software to illustrate some poorly accessibility design, at least, and that's some of the challenge that you have to. Now, I'm sure everybody's working on this, but you can talk a little bit more about dealing with that kind of technology.
Well, one aspect of technology of accessibility is that a student who is blind should not have to work that hard to get to content. There was information on the screen that a student using a screen reader never got to, because it was an image, that nine whatever long number, it was an image. And so one of the things that's happening currently with so many school districts going online and doing virtual academies, I am concerned that this whole issue of accessibility is not being adequately addressed, because not every student who is blind in North Carolina comes to our school.
Right.
So how do you help people understand what it really means to be accessible? One company wrote back and said, well, you know, you can use immersive reader in Microsoft. Well, if I can't get to that link because it's not labeled, I can't use immersive reader. So helping people understand up front so that you're not going back and trying to retrofit something, because who wants to go back and do something over? So helping people understand, even teachers, because we'll put a graphic up when we really should have like a PDF or a Word document.
So let me ask you one more question now. You talk about, first of all, trying to design the classroom and the technology to fit, but also this bigger question of creating an environment in your classroom and in your school that what you hope is the ideal, a kind of world that you want kids to live in, and understand that these labels can be painful. How do you manage that or navigate that world? Because they're going to go out into a world where that's not their reality, and you're creating this other world, which is an ideal, and that's what teaching should be. How do you manage that when they come back and say it's not like that out there?
One, always listen. I think, two, if we could get the emphasis off of grades and on lifelong learning, on building your legacy, I think that would help. I'm reading Stamp from the Beginning by Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, and I also read the book he did with Jason Reynolds, Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You. So bringing literature, oh, is so powerful, again, with the arts together. And I like what Jason Reynolds said. He calls segregationist haters, assimilationist cowards, and anti-racist lovers. And reading Dr. Kendi's book, I realized that I'm a assimilationist. I was brought up to be an assimilationist. And all my training as a teacher technically has taught me not to be an anti-racist, but to be an assimilationist. So that's where I am in my teaching experience.
Janet, I'm going to thank you very much for being with us. Janet Perez, Instructional Assistive Technology Facilitator at the Governor Moorhead School. Thanks so much, Janet.
Sorry. Bye-bye. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things.